Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. So before we go on to our guest today, and it's a really lovely story and a bit of a tearjerker as well, I just have a little announcement to make. After 98 episodes and 2 years and 4 months to be exact, the Big Travel Podcast has a sponsor. It's not something we've actually pursued before, but we have found a company. They're called WeCure, and they arrange for medical treatments abroad. And it's something I feel fits nicely with the podcast because of the travel element. I've also always been intrigued about health treatments abroad, and I know it's something that's on the rise. And indeed, I do know actually quite a few people who've traveled for dental treatment. In fact, people in the family I know who have done that, cosmetic treatment, and also fertility and miscarriage treatment. Some of you might know already that I had 5 miscarriages before I had my 2 children, and I had a lot of medical treatment for this. And because of this, I became a big part of some online support groups. And a lot of those people traveled abroad for treatment, and actually it went really well, although they were going through, you know, some reasonable challenging times because they were having fertility and miscarriage treatment. They actually got a great little holiday out of it and got to know parts of the world that they hadn't been before. So it's something I've always been quite intrigued about. In fact, talking of the miscarriage treatment, I'm actually going to have my miscarriage doctor on soon, as he's a world specialist in the field, a really interesting guy. But he has a jaw-dropping travel story that he just casually told me during the consultation, at the end of a consultation about the miscarriages. And honestly, my mouth was literally wide open with shock at his story that he just casually dropped in. So I'm going to have him on the podcast. But anyway, I digress, as I often do. WeCure are now going to give us a little bit of money for every episode. And like a lot of podcasts do this already, I'll be reading out a 30-second message from them at the beginning of the show. And there'll also be a code you can use in case you or anyone you know wants to use their services. They'll give you a great deal. Now, obviously, it's going to be very helpful to have some money for our work. I love doing this show, but it does take up a lot of time and also costs money in terms of monthly subscriptions for the podcast hosts. In equipment, I've bought 2 recorders, several lots of microphones. It didn't help that I left my microphones in Addis Ababa. Sounds like a great second album. But yeah, I did leave my microphones in Ethiopia a few months ago. I pay the lovely editor, Alex George, who does a wonderful job, edits so much better than I did for the first 30 or 40 episodes that I did on my own. Yeah, so it's going to be wonderful to be able to put some money into promoting the podcast on social media, because the more downloads we get, the more I can persuade interesting people to come on, and you know, the better for all of us. Some podcasts go down the route of Patreon, where they ask listeners to voluntarily donate to listen, but I wanted to keep it free for you. So I'm very pleased that we've got WeCure on board as a sponsor. It's not going to change anything. They have no influence in terms of guests or editorial input. It will still just be me nattering on in the usual manner with hopefully some brilliantly entertaining guests, which brings me nicely on to today's guest. First of all, I wanted to play this short clip from a video called Homeland Stories, Searching for Pearls, that's all about our guest today, Francesca.
From birth to death, they were ill. So I always knew that their lives would be short. Mum made me angry. She was 47 when she died. She deserved to live life to the full. Everything I do is for them. I've been given lungs to breathe, so I breathe for my brother, sister, and my mother.
So let's give Francesca the full Big Travel Podcast treatment. A chance encounter and some lost pearls led to Francesca Eyre, the owner of Chili Powder Ski Holidays in the French Alps, moving to the mountains. Growing up with 2 terminally ill siblings, she learned independence from a young age. And after losing her sister, age 16, and her mother, age 21, she felt the call of travel. As a part-time endurance athlete, a recent terrifying accident led to her memory being completely wiped for days and a very challenging recovery. But together with her husband Paul, she's now opening a second Chili Powder in a beautiful village in Provence and sees participating in incredible endurance events as a mean to, as she says, breathe for those who no longer can. Francesca Eyre is on the Big Travel Podcast. Where are you right now, Francesca?
So we're in my little piece of New Haven, and we're in our new house in Provence. So this is our new, our next chili powder chapter, which is very exciting. So we're getting it ready at the moment, and just it's been pouring with rain in the mountains for the last couple of weeks. So it was a little bit of an escape and excuse to paint.
Describe the scene to me. What does it look like there?
So we are on the edge of the Luberon National Park. It's a very old house. It's 200 years old. And for me, it's a very non-touristy village. It's just basically got one little bar and one little tiny, tiny shop and a post office in the mairie. And only locals here, only 900 residents. But we're right on the edge of lavender fields, thousands of vineyards, the mountains behind us. So it's incredibly beautiful.
This sounds absolutely idyllic and the dream for many people. I want to go through your journey and how you got to this point, but I just watched your wonderful video about your journey as to how you became this travel person. And honestly, you had me in tears. So why don't we start with that? Why don't we start with, I think the pearls are a significant turning point, but we have to explain why the pearls meant so much to you.
I think, the pearls meant so much to me because they belonged to my mother, and she died when I was 21, and I looked after her. She died of cancer, and I gave up work, and I looked after her as she was dying. She died in my arms, very luckily, for both of us. And after that, I wore her pearls almost as a security blanket that you have when you're a child. So I wore them the whole time. I never took them off. I went to do a wedding. They disappeared at the wedding. And that was sort of kind of that at that time. I mean, I was very, very upset. And eventually they came back to me just before Christmas via a very bizarre way. But I got them back. And the partner of the guy who had picked them up, he rang me and he said, I know Christmas is going to be tough for you because, you know, I've heard that these pearls mean a lot to you. Would you be interested in, as your chef, going to Morzine? I've got an acquaintance who needs a chef over Christmas. So I took the opportunity and fed my brothers, my siblings on Christmas Day, but flew out on Boxing Day.
And that's how you ended up living in Morzine for how long now?
Oh, 27 years. I mean, I should be about 99, I think, being in Morzine for that long. It's the longest place I've ever lived. But yes, 27 years.
But this wasn't the first time you moved to France, was it?
Yes. When I was 16, my parents had a really nasty divorce. My father, being a lawyer, bless his little cotton socks, I was in a little private school. I'm no longer paying for Francesca's education. She's not working properly. She's out. And so I had to leave school at 16. And I think my mother went, oh, my God, I've got the 16-year-old who's not finished her education. What the hell am I going to do with her? So she very brilliantly found me an au pair job in Paris. So I went to live in Paris when I was 16, and I was au pairing one and then two and then three children altogether.
16 is very young to leave home. It's actually the age I left home as well. I came from Spain to live in England. So I know how young that is. I also know it can be an exciting age to leave home. Was it an exciting time for you in Paris then?
No. I would never, ever, ever do it to my children. I was fine. I grew up with two terminally ill siblings. So I was very, very independent. So I was absolutely fine in independence. So, I was very lucky in that way. But I was very naive. And now looking back on it, I think, God, Francesca, you didn't go and see half the museums that you should have seen, the concerts that you could have gone to, the bars that you could have visited. I was a little bit square and a little bit, I was a little bit too sensible probably. So now I look back at it and I just think, there's no way I'd do that to my children.
That's really interesting because some people ask me like why I moved out of home so young. And I've always been very close to my parents. They're still together. You know, they're probably my best friends. And actually, I think almost because I had the confidence, because we were so close, I had the confidence to move early. And growing up in an international area where there are a lot of British people, expats, as they want to be called, or immigrants, as they actually are, a lot of people went back to the UK. A lot of people went back when they were 11, 12, 13 and went back to boarding school and things like that. So for me, it wasn't unusual. But now I look back and now I've got children, I moved to a different country, although it was my home country. I wasn't familiar with it. And I went to a place I'd never been before, just a month after my 16th birthday. And you are young, aren't you? You're more young and naive than you think you are. You think you're grown up at that age, but you're just not at all. Moving country is a big jump at that age.
Yeah, moving country is a big jump. I think, you know, my parents were going through such a nasty divorce that I think for them, it was better that I wasn't involved in watching what was going on. So it was sort of good timing on my mother's behalf. My sister was also getting very, very ill. In fact, she died when I was in Paris. So it was the most incredible experience. I was looking after his mother was a cookery writer. And they were the ones that said to my mother, right, Francesca has got a flair at cooking. She needs to become a chef. And that's why I then trained to become a chef.
You mentioned your sister was dying at the time when you were a 16-year-old in Paris. I mean, obviously, that must have been utterly, utterly heartbreaking. But you come from a family with cystic fibrosis. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, she has cystic fibrosis. The only thing was, I grew up always knowing that they were going to die at a young age. So it's not like somebody's been involved in an accident and that you don't know it's going to happen. If you're brought up always knowing that every day is a precious one, then I think you can mentally prepare yourself for it better when the time actually comes.
So two of your siblings had cystic fibrosis.
Yeah, that's right. So Jo died when she was 16 and, well, she's 15, 16 years old in her 16th year is how they said. And Nick died when he was 34. I have one other younger brother, number four, Robert, who lives in New Zealand. Yeah, sadly, the other side of the world, but he doesn't have cystic fibrosis.
Is that just, I don't know enough about it, is that just a genetic glitch? Is it just a chance? Did your parents know that they would have children with cystic fibrosis?
Well, I think this is where it becomes quite scary. There are 1 in 20 people are carriers of the cystic fibrosis gene. And then you have to be with somebody else who has the cystic fibrosis gene. And then there is a 1 in 4 chance that you give birth to a child with cystic fibrosis.
Presumably that could have been you as well with your children. You've got 3 children.
Yeah. So we decided, I know that I'm a carrier of cystic fibrosis. Paul, we could have had him tested, but I personally, having had siblings with cystic fibrosis, I wouldn't have terminated a CF baby. So we didn't want to know beforehand if Paul was a carrier or not. We decided we would wait and see. So they're tested as soon as they're born. None of mine have cystic fibrosis, thank goodness. And now they've got to make themselves have tests later on to see whether they're carriers or not, and then make their own decisions. But I won't have them tested to see if they're carriers now. I think, again, it's a personal choice. It's up to them to do it later.
So that period in Paris when your sister passed away, that must have been incredibly hard being away from home.
It was really hard. But I think because it was so horrific at home, it was easier being away than actually being there. And when you're busy, and I was working hard and I was looking after the children. So in fact, it just completely, you know, your mind is thinking of other things. So yes, it was extremely hard. And But in a way, I'm glad I wasn't there. Having to watch it every day would have been horrific.
So the family you're staying with this family in Paris, not going to the museums like you think you would. But then again, what 16-year-old girl does go to museums? The part you should have gone to the parties. You really should have gone to the parties. The museums, not so much at that age. I'm sure you've done them all now. But the grandmother suggested that you had a talent for cooking. And you went to Dublin, I believe, to train as a chef.
Yes. The grandmother said to my parents that I had a flair for cooking, that I should train to become a chef. So we looked at the Cordon Bleu school in Paris. And then at the time, it was about £3,000, equivalent to £3,000. And then we looked at London, and that was about £2,000. And then we looked at Dublin, and that was £1,000. And because my father had stopped all financial help for me, Mum begged him, and Dublin was the cheaper option. So I went and trained in Dublin.
What was that like moving to Dublin? I love Dublin. It's a great city. Please tell me you went to a few parties in Dublin.
I did. And I always said to Paul, when I first met Paul, if things don't work out in France, I'm moving back to Dublin. I loved Dublin. It's the most passionate, people are gorgeous, generous, just fantastic city.
I love anecdotes on the Big Travel podcast and stories. So tell me a real standout memory from your time in Dublin.
Oh, blimey. Well, I was very, very lucky. I trained as a chef and then I worked under an amazing chef called Mary O'Sullivan at the time, who did a lot of big private parties and catering and things like that. So we would cook in these beautiful stately homes. At the time, Ireland was running out of money and a lot of the stately homes were going bankrupt. So a way that they could cover some of their bills was to invite people into their houses to have dinner and to see the stately house with the owners. So it was something called Hidden Ireland. So Mary and I used to cook in these stunning stately homes. I can remember once going to have to up to Dublin, about 40 minutes away, to go and buy a lobster. And we came down and I was not with Mary that time. I was with a vegetarian chef. And we got the lady that we were chefing for wanted hot lobster. So we got our pot of hot water ready. We had stroked the lobster's head to put the lobster asleep. We'd put the lobster in the freezer to put the lobster asleep because the other chef was vegetarian and we had to do everything very kindly. And we got to the pot of boiling water and realized that the pot of boiling water was too small, but the guests were all sitting at the table. So we had to put the lobster head first in with the tail thrashing around. So we had two female chefs in the kitchen, floods of tears over cooking a lobster.
Oh, I can imagine. I don't eat meat, but I do eat fish. But things like that, they just do break my heart. You can see you're a chef, so obviously I'm guessing you eat everything. But you can see like how easy it is to become, you know, vegan actually, almost, when you think about things like that, don't you think?
Yeah. No, it was very funny. I mean, we were pathetic. And then we had to serve this lobster at wiping our makeup free and trying to look as though we weren't crying chefs in the kitchen.
So let's go back. So you went on from Dublin and then ended up working as a chef did you come back to England at that point?
Well, what happened was I was working as a chef in Dublin. Everything was fine. Everything was great. Mum was then diagnosed with cancer. I had to give up work. I spent 6 months looking after her and she decided that she would try anything. And they told her she only had a few months to live. She then heard from somebody about doing a macrobiotic diet. So she said that, could I chef for her and do a macrobiotic diet for her, which I did. She then sadly died and I had two siblings that were under 18. So my stepfather, my mother and my stepfather, they weren't married because there was no divorce in Ireland. So I had these two kids in Ireland, under 18. And financially, I couldn't look after them. Mum, you know, left us with a debt, bless her heart. So I had to take them back to their father, who by that stage, sadly, was estranged. So took them back to England and they went to live with their dad in England and I moved to London.
Do you know what? What a cruel blow to have your mum pass away of cancer with the, you know, having dealt with the with having two terminally ill children. As a parent now, it just doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
I think it's the stress. I think I'm quite sure stress will link to other diseases. If you know, she had so much stress in her life, my mother, that I think, you know, one thing after another meant that she couldn't, you know, her immune system was down.
Yeah, and talking about food in that sense, you know, what you feed yourself and nourish yourself with must really, you know, take on paramount importance. I mean, unfortunately, it's not everything, is it? You know, do you, as a chef, do you consider those sort of things?
200%. I mean, I know Mum never had time to eat properly, and because she was having to do physio on the two children, so she would grab a Mars bar and shove a Mars bar down her throat before having to do physio on them. I got rheumatoid arthritis. I've got the half a thyroid. So I'm really careful with what I eat. And when I was first diagnosed, I was very, very careful, came off all sorts of gluten, all sorts of things, was incredibly careful. Now I'm back on everything, but I didn't drink any alcohol for 9 years because it used to seem to flare up my arthritis and things. So no, I totally think what you eat really affects your body.
Describe, I'm hypothyroid. Did you say hyper or hypo? Hyper, I'm hypo actually. I developed it. That's so hypo, for anyone who doesn't know, is the underactive thyroid. And I developed it when I was 21, which was a really horrible experience because one of the main things is that you put on weight without sort of really doing anything to put on weight. And I remember going on all sorts of diets and trying to exercise and just being exhausted. I put on about 3 stone in 6 weeks. Prior to that, I'd been modeling, you know, swimwear and, you know, doing quite a bit of part-time modelling. I was on the stage and performing a lot, and I just got very, very sick very quickly. And actually, back when I was 21, there was no internet, so you just couldn't Google it. And it took a long time to get diagnosed. And I know that's an experience with a lot of people as well.
No, I was doing a lot of exercise at the time, and I was doing a lot of racing and things. And I got very, 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 very thin. And everybody kept on saying to me, will you stop doing so much exercise? And I kept on saying, I'm eating so much. And that's how I was diagnosed. It was just, I'd got so thin.
Yeah, it's a nasty illness. It really is. And a lot of the time with women, you know, unfortunately, they go undiagnosed for a while, because if you're particularly with underactive, if you're tired and putting on weight, people will say, oh, well, that's just your age or whatever. But I was 21. So talking of exercise, you moved to Morzine, which is in the French Alps, a beautiful place. I have been there. I had a great press trip there with Roxy, you know, the snowboarding and surfy people, and they do fabulous clothes and things. And I went there and I learned to snowboard in Morzine, actually, a beautiful place. But so tell us about chili powder.
So I went to Morzine through the Pearls, arrived in Morzine, fell in love with Morzine, decided to sell up my little business that I had in London. So sold that and decided that my heart was in Morzine. So came out to Morzine, also having had number two brother with cystic fibrosis. The mountains are really, really good for your lungs and cystic fibrosis. So I brought him out with me, left him at a chalet with a chalet company, and said to the chalet company, look, please, can he work with you? I'll leave you a few wages for him. Can you please give him a job? So he stayed in Morzine, and I spent that year traveling backwards and forwards from London, then sold the business, and then came to Morzine. So the first year I was working for another company, I was their resort manager, and then met Paul. So met Paul, straight away knew that Paul eventually we would be together for a long time. I made him work for me. He spent a long time walking me back to the house, saying goodnight, going back to his flat and going, bloody hell, when will I break this girl? So we dated for a long time, and then we decided that we wanted to set up a business together. And that was how Chili Powder was born. He is amazing at accounts and maths. So he's the mathematical side. And then I'm the front of house side.
And Chili Powder is, for those people who don't know,
a ski company. We're a ski company in Morzine, in the French Alps. So we started off with one chalet. We then decided that renting a chalet was actually a bad investment that we would build. So we put a plan together. The banks laughed at us. We tried to get investors. The investors laughed at us. And eventually, some people that we knew said that they wanted to invest in us. So they put up half the money, and then we could raise half the money from the bank. And at the time, it was £1 million, so that we could then build our hotel.
Wonderful. So you have a hotel now in Morzine. And what's it like? I've always been very curious about going to the Alps in the summer. I have been as a child, but I haven't been as an adult. And I'm always just the vision of, you know, beautiful wild flowers and, you know, twirling around in a large skirt. I've obviously seen The Sound of Music too many times through the mountains. What is it like in the summer? Describe it to me.
Well, if you ask Paul and I which part of the year we prefer, both of us would say the summer. The summer is so beautiful. It takes on a very, very, guests are very, very different. In the winter, skiing's expensive. They have to get out at certain lifts. They have to be back at certain time. They have to achieve certain amount. Where during the summer, everybody's a lot more relaxed. People are quite happy just to sit around at the hotel and be in the garden and read. Or you go whitewater rafting, you can play tennis, parapointing, mountain biking. You have something called a multipass, which is €2 per person per day. And this pass allows you to do masses of activities for just €2. So in fact, it's a relatively reasonable holiday when skiing's an expensive holiday.
That sounds wonderful. I really would love to go in the summer months, definitely, because I'm not a skier. I've tried a few times and found it very scary. I can snowboard now, but I haven't done it for so long. I'd like to maybe try and give that another chance. But if you weren't a part of a skiing family growing up, then you kind of like, you know, you have to, learning as an adult is a little bit more complicated sometimes, I think.
Yeah, very tough, very tough. What you have to do is when you're going down a mountain, you have to sing. So then your brain isn't thinking about what the hell you're going down. So you just sing to yourself.
That's exactly when your brain's thinking, what the hell are you going down? I remember thinking the very first time, I'm standing on very slippy things down this very slippy slope. I'm on a mountain. This doesn't feel right. But when you do start to get it, you know, it really is exhilarating.
I think it's one of the things about skiing, because I do ask myself, you know, you are putting on metal planks on your feet, going fast down a mountain. Why is it such a popular sport? But I think because you're going down a mountain, it is beautiful, beautiful, beautiful scenery. So you're concentrating on the scenery. You're concentrating on where you're going. You can eat good food because you're doing exercise, so therefore you're not putting on masses of weight. You cannot think about the email you need to reply to because you've got to concentrate on what you're doing. So I think that's why people like it so much, because they can mentally really switch off.
Oh, and the après ski is just amazing, isn't it? Have you taken advantage of the parties on the après ski scene?
Well, no, because we work massively. But yes, we did. Yes, when we were younger, absolutely. No, the après ski is awesome, and it's all part of it. It's great being able to have a beer up in the mountains before you hit the last slope to come down.
I remember some very strong hot chocolate with rum as well when you're up on the slopes. That's really quite rewarding. And afternoon tea being a massive thing as well.
Yeah, you've worked hard. You've worked hard skiing down those moguls. So you're allowed to have that cake in the afternoon.
Definitely. So you are incredibly fit, aren't you? Didn't you recently do a challenge that resulted in you having quite a bad accident?
Yeah, no, I was very fit. Half of the reason why I used to do so much exercise, I think when you have a hotel and we live on site, is that you don't have a second to yourself. As soon as you step out that door, you see things that need doing. You see, I'm 5 meters away from the hotel, so I can see the garden, and I do the garden, so I can see how much weeding, etc., needs to be doing. So I did a lot and lot and lot of big events, and my thing was endurance. I love endurance events, and I'm not a sprinter, but I can keep on going. So I had last May the 12th, I had an endurance event, which wasn't a serious event for me. I was doing it as a training run because later on in the year, I was doing Land's End to John O'Groats. So it was a cycle race, and it was a 300-kilometer cycle race, but over 2 days. So I wasn't worried about it at all. First day went absolutely fine because I wasn't racing it. It was all very relaxed. I've done like the Étape de Tour de France before, so I've done some, you know, some big, big races before. So this was all very relaxed. I had a really good night's sleep. I was 50 kilometers before the end of the race on the second day. I had eaten, probably fueled at a fueling station. I always, because I do endurance, I always fuel myself properly. And then we do not know. I was out, I was unconscious for about 20 minutes. They have worked out. I've got memory loss of, I was 5 days in hospital. I've got memory loss of at least 15 days. And then after that, my memory comes in and out. I had really bad concussion, fractured my spine just below my neck. So I was incredibly lucky, and sort of damaged all my shoulder, but didn't break, damaged all my face, but didn't break. So yes, that was my biking race.
So you don't know how it happened. Does anyone know how it happened?
No, I was at the time, the rest of my team had stopped at the feeding station to have coffee, and I was fine. So I was going ahead and I was absolutely fine. The first people who found me, thank goodness, was a nurse and a fireman who were also racing. Now, when the police came, I couldn't speak. They held my hand, so I would squeeze their hand to answer what had happened. They asked me if I'd been hit by a car, and I answered yes. But no witnesses, and I have no idea. I've got no memory at all of it. So,
gosh, that must be really disorienting, losing 5 days of your life.
That hasn't worried me. It's never upset me. A lot of people have said that. Has that really upset you? And no, that hasn't upset me. Concussion, I mean, thank goodness now it has come more into the highlights in the press with some you know, famous people getting concussed, because it is, and I think it depends where you get concussed as to what part of the brain will it affect. But where I was concussed mostly is sort of around my eye, in that, the front of my head, the forehead. And that affected me mentally. It's the most horrific feeling ever. And if somebody wanted to break my leg, do never, ever concuss me again like that.
Why? What was the feeling?
You are not yourself. You are very, very scared. I don't agree with this. I'm not this type of person at all. And I'm telling people because I think people need to be aware. I was very suicidal. Had no idea why, had no control of my brain at all. I could talk, but it felt as though all my words were coming out of the back of my head, not out of my mouth.
And you sound okay now. I mean, physically, mentally, how are you recovered? How recovered are you?
Now, absolutely fine. It took, I reckon it took 9 months. I never had acute headaches that some people with concussion get, really bad headaches. I was lucky that I didn't have that. It was just mentally for me, it was very, very difficult. Just lost all my confidence, couldn't cope with seeing anybody, couldn't cope with people around me. And I run a hotel, so I'm so used to people and I love people, but couldn't walk into the hotel at all. So I was very lucky. My husband gave me the whole of the summer, last summer off. He said, look, don't work at the hotel, you're to get yourself better. So I was able to work at home. At the time, we had invested in the house in Provence, so I was able to work on the house in Provence and getting all the furniture and getting all that sorted out. Now, because I think I haven't used my brain for a year properly, my brain doesn't work as well as it used to. So, for example, if you told me four figures, like if say the PIN code of my cards, I can't remember the PIN codes of my cards. I have to have them written down. If you told me your name quickly, I would have to really, really think about remembering your name. Where that's not me. I'm a hotelier. I could always remember everybody's name.
It sounds to me like you've been, and you still are, thankfully, you've regained that spirit, but you've been very brave and very adventurous and really grabbed life, you know, grabbed it and held on. Do you think that growing up with two terminally ill siblings and also losing your mum early has shaped that personality?
Definitely. There's no point looking back at the past. There's no point reliving what you've done, except the good things, except the nice things, obviously. But you have to live each day and you have to take each day as it comes. And the accident was on May the 12th, which is my mother's birthday. Ah. So I think mum was going, right, I'm not going to kill you, but you've got to slow down. So I'm going to damage you a little bit. So it gives you time to think and adjust yourself in life.
So what is the future? You don't look back. You've still got chili powder in Morzine, and now you are sitting in what sounds like a beautiful house in Provence, which sounds like an absolute dream for many of us. What is the future? What is the plan now for you?
So the Paul, again, he's heaven, thank God. And he's been just so gracious in saying, Francesca, right, we have spent 17 years building up the hotel. We've got a manager, we've got a staff manager. You are there to be in the hotel, to come and be with the guests and talk to the guests, but not to be ironing sheets or cleaning bedrooms or doing all the bits and pieces that sometimes you have to do because, you know, you want everything to be absolutely perfect. We've got managers to do that. So now, for last winter, I took the winter off as well. So the summer I was ill, so couldn't do anything last summer. Last winter I took the winter off as well. So I was in and out with guests, becoming a wonderful mother that I never had time to be, cooking bread, doing all the things that I wanted to do. And then it got to confinement. And confinement, I just cooked for the children, cooked and cleaned. And at the end of confinement, I said to Paul, I went, oh my God, all the time, all these years, I've said that, oh, I wish that I was a full-time mother and didn't work. I've lied. That's complete and utter rubbish. I love my children, but I don't love cleaning up after them the whole time. I would love to set Provence up as a bed and breakfast and run Provence in the summer and in the interseason as a bed and breakfast and go back to chefing how I used to chef before. So doing breakfasts, making everything, making the granola, making the breads, obviously buying in the croissants, making my own jams, doing all that. So that's what's happening now. I'm running Provence as a bed and breakfast. Paul and the managers will run the hotel. I'll be backwards and forwards. Due to what has happened this year, I don't think we're going to open the hotel until August. We're not sure at the moment. We're just waiting for all the new rules and regulations. So I'll run Provence and Paul will run the hotel. And then when I'm back, I can just talk to guests and do all the nice stuff. And the town is in Cabrières-d'Aigues, which is a tiny, tiny town. One side's Catholic, one side's Protestant, which is really rare in France to have that. And it's just the most beautiful place.
It sounds amazing. I honestly can't wait. And I hopefully I'll make it there one day. Before I ask you my last question, is there anything you think I've missed?
I don't think so. I mean, it is the main reason why we set up the hotel the way it is was because of going back to Ireland and me cooking in those private homes. I didn't want to have a hotel. I wanted to have a family home where people could come and stay and feel as though they were at home, and that if they wanted to come down for breakfast in their pajamas, they could come down to breakfast in their pajamas. I wanted it to have the fire and health and safety of a hotel, but to have the feeling of a private home.
Sounds absolutely perfect. So my last question is always about music, because to me and to many people, music and travel go very much hand in hand. So if you had to choose one song that reminds you of a special, a memorable time and place of travel, what is that song and what is that memory?
Oh, that's really unfair. You're talking to somebody with who's had concussion, so my brain does not work. Right, what song? Oh God, there are so many songs. Stereophonics, my husband plays the guitar beautifully, and my brother with cystic fibrosis, his job was he used to sing in the bars in Morzine, and he's got had the most amazing husky voice. So so the Stereophonics were a big part then. Yeah.
Now that's really good. Tell me a memory of your brother, if you can, if you do remember your brother singing in Morzine, and if there was a particular song that stuck out.
Oh, can I scream up to my daughter and ask her? She's got it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Eloise, what's Nick's song? Rule the World by
Take That.
Yeah, that was played at his funeral. Yeah, Nick used to sing that. I mean, Nick had the most amazing voice. He recorded one song, and his voice is so deep because the guitar on his, and husky because the guitar on his lungs. And Rule the World was played. We had two live, somebody on the guitar, somebody singing at his funeral, playing that. And yes, it reminds me totally of my brother and will make me cry when I hear it.
As Francesca mentioned, her brother Nick was a talented singer and musician, and after we spoke, she sent us this song of his. Because he wrote and recorded it himself, we have permission to play it. Here's Nick Curzon-Bavin with his song, Can't Stop the Rain.
And now